Hi, my name's Giovanni Ribisi, and I'm on the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey, Ilya, how's it going, man?
Going pretty well. How about you?
Can't complain. Very excited. Turned in a script to a producer yesterday. Just sitting here, like, waiting to find out what is said.
Hey, we have teased it for a couple of weeks now.
Ooh, but we really milked this one.
But we did. But it's a really, really good one. Who is on the show today and next week?
Okay, so a little backstory. I think all three of us, you, myself, and Alana Cody, our producer, all get emails pitching different cinematographers to us. And one day, not long ago, I got one of those emails, and, you know, like, we always consider it, we always run it up the flagpole, talk about it, whatever, but something blew my mind about the request, because the name of the cinematographer seemed somewhat familiar to me, and it was a fella named Giovanni Ribisi.
Giovanni Ribisi, the actor, you know, from Avatar and dozens of other movies.
Richard Linklater's Suburbia. You know, anyone?
Yeah, exactly. You just keep going. That guy.
No, he's been in so many. I mean, honestly, he's a great actor. He's been in tons and tons of stuff. He's in Boiler Room. I mean, like, he's also
Sneaky Pete, which was great. And that was only from a couple of years ago. And he even got to direct an episode of Sneaky Pete. So, yeah.
So he's somebody whose work I respect. And of course, the first thing I do is look on IMDb and make sure it's the same Giovanni Ribisi. I mean, there could be two. And of course it is. And again, like, as someone who has loved his acting work over the years, but, you know, and I did a little, I mean, I won't say I did the most exhaustive internet research, but I did some searching to see, like, is there any history of actors turned cinematographers? Like, is that a thing? And I could find nobody except Giovanni Ribisi, who had shot this film called Strange Darling. So we all talked about it. We were like, let's do it. This is a very interesting take. And then they sent us the screener, and I was like, please don't suck, please don't suck, please don't suck.
And to be fair, we didn't know anything about Strange Darling. Strange Darling, an indie film, relatively low budget indie film, but it's got a couple of, you know, good, highly, you know, it's got name talent in it. It's got, you know, very talented people, and it's not so low budget. It's got a few million dollars, shot in Oregon, and it...
In your backyard.
In my backyard, yeah. And holy crap, it's... I was so blown away. So
I was blown away, and I was blown away by the quality of the cinematography. I mean, like, the acting is good, the directing is great. I love the way the script is written, but the cinematography is so—it's just like sumptuous. It is like it's a great dark noir thriller. The first card that comes up says "shot on 35mm film," which I feel like is definitely a line in the sand for certain people, us included. And I mean, it looks great. Like, it looks great. I don't want to get too much into our interview with Giovanni, but talking to him was amazing, because obviously he's somebody who he has been acting since he was like 12, possibly younger. He's been acting younger, since he was a kid.
Yeah.
He's been in tons of stuff, but he's been thinking about being a cinematographer for over a decade, and has been sort of doing it I won't say on the sly, but like as like a sideline. And this is his first entry into, hey, look at me, world. I'm a professional DP. And I think he killed it.
He agreed. The guy did a fantastic job. And, you know, we're burying the lead a little bit. You can go see this movie probably at about the same time this episode goes live, because it's going to be in theaters nationwide August 23rd. So really, really soon. So,
and I know that I'm constantly talking about going to movie theaters, but support movies like this. Firstly, this movie's very entertaining. This is not homework. This is not eat your broccoli kind of movie. This is a very engaging, entertaining movie, and give it a chance. See it on a big screen.
And I'll add that this is not a movie that you want to wait on, because there is enough of a twist and twists in the movie that if someone else goes to it or reviews start coming out, you could easily spoil the impact, especially if some reviewer was just
That was one of the things I loved about it, is through the whole movie, like, you know, we're so used to seeing movies where you can kind of, if you've seen a lot of movies, as we all have, you can kind of see where it's going. This one, I had no freaking idea where it was going, and I would not dare spoil it for anybody, but I feel like, yes, see it before people start spoiling it. I want to see this movie become a sleeper hit, because I just think if we hadn't interviewed Giovanni, I would still think this was a freaking cool movie. To me, it's like if Quentin Tarantino and like Memento era Christopher Nolan got together and made like a super dark noir thriller that was kind of sexy.
And huge props to J.T. Molnar, the director of the mm-hmm. of the project. He and Giovanni worked together in a really seamless way. They have I got to go to a special, very intimate Q&A with Giovanni and J.T. Last week at the Kodak House in Hollywood, which, let me tell you, the Kodak House, I think it is a place where Kodak promotes the use of film for the motion picture industry. They also, I think you can buy film actually from that location. And it seems like they sort of do these intimate little Q&A sort of events. And it was great. I got an extra, like, even though we talked to Giovanni for hours, hearing from him and the director at this Q&A, I have even more appreciation. Now they told even more stories. And it's an intimate story, but at the same time, it is also extremely accessible, and there's a lot going on, and you don't even realize all the things that are going on for the first half of the movie. The more the movie goes on, the more you're like, the more it reveals itself, the more your expectations change. And by the time you get to the end, it's like, holy crap, you wove through this roller coaster.
I can't honestly wait to see it again, because when I saw it, it was on a screener, so I had to watch it on my computer monitor. And I want to see it on a big ass screen.
Well, I got good news for you, because Giovanni revealed at the Q&A that the distributor, who has never distributed a movie before, this is their first theatrical release, they're called Magenta Light. They've worked a deal so that there's a print being struck. You don't have to even just see it digitally. You can go see it on 35mm film in Los Angeles at the Vista Theater. So that's my God.
That's like one of the best theaters in LA too.
It really is.
Oh my God. One of the ones that's owned by Quentin Tarantino. I love that theater.
Fantastic. Well, then we could talk about who's going to be on the show for a long time, but this is still a regular episode.
And now, Close Focus.
What is our Close Focus? What do we got to yak about this week?
Well, we kind of have a twofer. It's not really a roundup, just kind of a twofer of things, because we both kind of had something that was kind of a bee in our bonnet. Would you like me to go first, or would you like to go first?
Either way, go for it.
All right. Well, I'd like to talk about it. There was an article that covers this in The Hollywood Reporter, written by Katie Kilkenny, called "As AI Encroaches on Hollywood, Animators Say This is an Existential Moment." And it's something that I think has been kind of in the pipeline for a minute, unfortunately. Like, you know, because of my interest in AI and the uses of AI, I get fed a lot of AI stuff, like on YouTube and whatnot. And I keep seeing this video that I will not click on that says, like, make Pixar level animation, you know, no art, no skills required. And the thing is that when we talk about jobs that could be sucked away and handed off to generative AI, animation, already there is generative animated AI. And it seems like kind of a no-brainer. And I actually feel like no matter what, some tasks of animation are going to be going to generative AI, just because it's going to be a more efficient way to do something, you know, some kind of grunt work that people have to do. And I feel like everyone at every level of the industry has got to get used to that thought. But I could also see generative AI, especially in the hands of the right kind of cheap ass jerk producer, being used instead of artists, honestly, or instead of voice artists. And so the Animation Guild is protesting.
Well, you're a dad. You've already seen some of the schlocky animation that is quickly done to appeal to kids who, you know, are not necessarily the most critical viewers.
I just want to say little kids have, like, no taste at all. The younger, the worst.
Well, they certainly don't have any real understanding of production value when it comes to animation. Yeah,
a fun YouTube channel is like Siskel and Ebert, but it's like 2 3-year-olds.
Everything's a thumbs up. Everything.
I liked the colors. Yes. I liked the bouncing things. So, anyway, go on.
So here's the point. Like I've known some people who've made some pretty good animated projects and some pretty poor animated projects, especially ones that are sort of done cheaply. And the way it was in the past was it used to be traditionally animated, but then switched to computer animation. In some ways, AI feels like the next evolution of some level of computer animation. And I already know that there's some in-between frames and stuff which are rendered and generated and stuff like that where a human being didn't have
That's the kind of thing that it's like, hey, AI, go crazy, AI.
But at the same time, I also feel like AI is now not necessarily the straw man argument, but it is the bugaboo that every creative union is going to hold up now as, you know, protections are required in order for us to keep doing our thing. So I have a feeling that anyone who's negotiating with labor unions, especially in post-production and animation or anything having to do with artistic crafts that would be computer generated anyway, they should just know going in that this is going to be a thing. This is going to be a point of contention, and it's going to be we talked earlier about lines in the sand with film. There's going to be a line in the sand with humans and animation because, you know, people have talked, specifically the Russo brothers talked about how you're going to be able to generate a movie starring you and Marilyn Monroe and
which I say bullshit. Like I don't see that happening.
But there is the ability for you already to have a terrible, terrible animated thing generated. It won't
for
look
sure.
great. It won't it sound great. It won't do great things. But you can generate some animated stuff that, I mean, nobody wants to watch that, but just the fact that technology exists makes a lot of people nervous and
should.
So.
I mean, I think in the animation world, it should, because you can get enough of a sample of someone's voice. Imagine if you had a giant sample of Dan Castellaneta's voice yeah. and you had an AI system that could pose Homer Simpson however you wanted. You could probably make a reasonable facsimile of Homer Simpson without Dan Castellaneta being involved and without any of the artists being involved. You could probably do it to a degree. I mean, the thing that I've always found about generating stuff in AI is it's very imprecise, and it's impossible to get. If you have an image in your mind that you want it to make, it's not going to give it to you. And I don't think the technology is even there for that to be that good. But I feel like the animation workers need to head this shit off at the pass right now and get assurances. So I don't know what the Animation Guild is able to accomplish, but I feel like I'm actually very much on their side on this one.
Yeah. Well, we also should probably mention the fact that there was another big sort of tumultuous thing going on in the industry right now, which is that the NBA has signed a new deal with Disney, which is ABC and ESPN, Comcast, and Amazon to air all of the NBA and WNBA games for the 2025-2026 season. Now, this was a $76 billion deal, like billion with a B. It was a huge money deal. Warner Brothers, TNT, they had the rights before, and they are claiming that they have some first look or some sort of agreement where maybe the NBA can't just immediately go and make a deal with somebody else. So there's sort of like some saber rattling of some potential legal implications. But the reason that I'm bringing all this up, why am I bringing up sports and the whole idea of entertainment? But when we're talking about these large entertainment conglomerates, and we talked last week about how Warner Brothers Discovery wrote down the value of their operation by $9 billion. Part of that has to do with the fact that NBA is not on their books. It's not on their schedule. They don't have a done deal with that. And so having that move over to these other conglomerates, it's big, big money. The NBA and live sports is something that is definitely not going away, but it is also something that the traditional broadcasters, they had the most eyeballs. They had the most access. So sports was always looking for the most eyes. They're not saying that they don't want the most eyes anymore. They think there's more eyes through the streaming service greater than Warner Brothers can offer. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next. So,
been a crappy year to be Warner Brothers, I gotta tell you. Like, I you know.
Yes, indeed. Stock price is still hovering around the same point that it was in the last time we spoke, about $7.
So. We're not a financial podcast, but not at all. I still think we should all go buy some Warner Brothers stock because it will go up
at some point. Yeah. I just don't know when that will be.
Yeah, Warner Brothers is. I have an impossible time imagining that Warner Brothers and Discovery Networks and HBO and all those people have permanently lost that much value.
That'd be crazy. I think that everyone is actually though is going to wake up really, really quickly here and go like, why are we hurting and what can we do to make ourselves better? Wouldn't you know it? It's make better movies and television. The same thing that everyone's been trying to cut back from, making better movies and television gets eyeballs.
They have to, yeah. But yeah. I also feel like... There's something that we haven't really discussed as a culture, a reckoning we haven't come to, which is that we all saw streaming. I think the first time I ever saw streaming was at your house on Netflix like 12 years ago. And it was an early adopter, for sure.
It
was like, holy shit, that's awesome, right? But like a lot of new technology, people didn't embrace it the right way when it came along, and they didn't. There was no plan. Nobody had a better idea about how to do it. And you think, okay, well, we're taking a bunch of shows that are on linear television and we're putting them on a streaming platform. How different could that be? Turns out it's crazy different. crazy different. And, you know, like what we talked about last week about sort of cable TV hitting all these rough spots, it's like, you know, like, do people like to laugh less than they liked to laugh 10 years ago? No. Is Comedy Central, is it harder to get somebody to turn on a television and put on Comedy Central? Yeah, it is. Where do these brands land in streaming and they don't know how to do it? And the sports piece of it is, I think, maybe where like the power completely moves from television to streaming. Well, when I say television, I mean linear television.
Linear television, yeah. Well, one thing's for sure, we're not going to get the real reckoning and understanding at this point in time, but we are paying close attention to it. And so definitely in the coming months and years, we will have a better understanding of where linear television plays with all of this other stuff. So I don't see it going away, but you know, there's an awful lot of changes that are happening right now. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. One thing's for sure, it won't be boring. So, Ben, why don't we get to the interview now with Giovanni Ribisi?
Oh, and we should mention, this is part one. We're going to have a part two next week.
That's correct. So there'll probably be a cliffhanger where the interview will stop and then we'll reappear and then we'll...
Giovanni will be like, put down that knife! And then come back next week to see if we murdered him.
But that... Next week, we're going to get into the interview right away. So pretty much, there'll be a little bit of a cliffhanger. We'll have the rest of the show. And then next week, you'll get the rest of the interview, which will be awesome. So, yeah. And it's because we talked to him for hours and we had so much good stuff. That's why it's a two-parter. So,
so interesting.
So please enjoy Giovanni Ribisi.
Here we go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
You know, I mean, I've been shooting and using cameras all my life, handed down from my mother. But this was, I guess, more or less me coming out of the closet, you know, and just sort of, I guess, yeah, you know, at a certain point, you just have to stop caring what anybody else thinks and just dive in and hope for the best.
I mean, it was awesome. We were both blown away.
And, that means a lot. Thanks.
You know, yeah. I mean, obviously, we watch hundreds of movies every year, and we're always talking to DPs. And I was kind of looking through like trying to find any other time where like an established actor had become a cinematographer, and you're the only one I can think of. You're the only one that came up.
Oh, is that right? Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I grew up on film sets. I became an actor when I was 9 years old. Wow. And just sociologically, really, you know, working next to the camera department my whole life, you know, with this incredible machine, which ultimately became a curiosity and then an obsession. And as it does with anybody interested in photography or cinematography, there's a part of me that wonders how I could have helped, just because it's and I guess I also have a technical fascination just with engineering and you know, sort of trying to unearth the mystery or the magic of what these guys do and did my whole life. And so I don't know, that's probably sounds really pretentious, but
no, you know, that's why we're here. I mean, like, yeah, you know,
quite the opposite. No, yeah, actually that you sound exactly like so many DPs that we talk to. I mean, oh, this is like, you know, right, you have the bug like so many other people. Like, you know, there's this, sure, incredible confluence of the technological, of the art, and then, you know, it doesn't just, you know, pretty pictures don't just happen. You have to like coax them or squeeze them or fight them into existence. And
sure, look, yeah, exactly.
You know, usually we do a little bit more like sort of a formal start here, but we're on such a nice roll. I just want to keep going straight into this here.
But yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing is that, you know, people have been asking me now that that it's out, that the movie's being released, and people are, I guess, aware that I've been involved photographing the movie. That the difference between acting and cinematography, and really, I guess it, for me, it sort of summarizes being with acting. You know, you start from sort of a subjective place where you want to work from the inside out on a character to sort of establish or understand the experience of what the writer had intended for that person or for that character. And and correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't, you know, this is just my take on it. it's definitely, it has a distinction from acting, but it's the inversion of that. It's an objective launching pad, trying to get more subjective, really, you know, for a story. So when you look at some of the great photographers and cinematographers as their images, you're looking at something and then it takes you to a certain place emotionally or intellectually, you know, subjectively, really, you know. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's it. And for me, I guess this is one of the great things really about the medium of movie making and film, is that it does take the objective and the subjective together. And it's the sort of the apex of that for me, beyond anything, you know. For me, it encompasses music and photography and editing and writing and performance and it's sort of the amalgamation of all of that. So I don't know.
Giamana, you've been acting since the mid 80s, and it sounds like you've had a camera in your hand for a long time too. When did you turn the camera portion of this, you know, when did you turn this fascination into this obsession to now actually, you know, going out and deciding that you're going to shoot stuff? How many decades was that? Or have you been shooting stuff, you know, kind of quietly all along on the side? Where's your camera journey begin?
I think of my life sort of as a succession of a series of midlife crises, you know, because I don't know, you know, where that midpoint is. And so, you know, going way back, you know, the decision to become an actor was a 9-year-old's decision. Mm-hmm. At a certain point, you know, I think my first movie was Star Wars. And so run to the lights, as they say. I was just enamored with that at that age. And my mother indulged me and my sisters. And there was a friend of ours down the street who had gotten an agent. And so it was kind of like, and we're in Los Angeles and it's, you know, the blockbuster era, yada, yada. So we got in and then we started working. And then suddenly it was like, oh, right, adult responsibilities. And then you get on that treadmill and it starts to be lucrative. And then at certain points, you know, I got into an acting class and, discovered, you know, what was going on in the Actors Studio and, Marlon Brando and, Gary Oldman and everybody, all of what they were doing in the '90s. And that became my obsession, and it still is, really. And then at one point, as I was mentioning, having a sort of a technical inclination, I got involved after I did a movie called Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow. Sure. And was like, oh my gosh, well, you can just go and from your living room, make a big, massive feature film if you want to by yourself. And so I got really into visual effects, and I went to the Gnomon School in
Holland. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, you know, you're familiar for quite some time. And then that became, you know, what that was started out as like two classes a week, and then it was six classes a week. And then I was just doing nothing but that, sitting in front of a computer. And at one point I realized I was broke and I had to go get a job
and money. Yeah.
And, yeah. Adult responsibilities. And so from there, having that experience, at one point doing a movie, the producer came to me with some IP or intellectual property that involved visual effects and computer graphic imaging. And we started talking, and we eventually formed a company, and we grew that company, and we partnered, and we ended up selling it. And there was a moment where I had an opportunity to kind of like, the come to Jesus conversation with myself of what I really wanted to do. And without even really thinking about it or having any reason whatsoever, I was just drawn towards cinematography and photographing and making my own, I don't want to say content, but you know,
images,
telling my own stories, I guess. Which
thank you for
out,
not saying content. We're very yeah, allergic to, yeah, to, we, to we the content that, word here.
Yeah, yeah. It's the C word on the show.
Yeah, it is the C word. Oh gosh, I know, right? Files. but yeah, so I started out, with documentaries, and it was me and one other person. We were in a Sprinter van driving around following this band, and then it just became this thing that grew over 15 years, it just became my life, you know, really, and everything else sort of professionally supporting that.
Yeah, because this movie doesn't look like it was shot by somebody who just decided to try cinematography out. It's got such a full, beautiful, you know, visual language to it that, you know, like had you not been a movie star, we still would have been like, oh my God, what a great looking movie.
Ben, and also, we gotta jump in and actually tell our listeners and our viewers, you know, what this movie is called. It's called Strange Darling.
We haven't talked about it at all.
It's going to be coming out soon. It's going to be coming out in August. And
I hope theatrically.
Yeah, it is coming out theatrically, which is, that's its own saga. But just, so well deserved from the director for the director, I should say. It's coming out, I guess, on 1,500 screens or something like that.
In August. I will be going back to see it on the big screen because, you know, I got to see it on a screener. So I was able to watch it on a good computer monitor, but I wasn't able to watch it. The screener won't even let you screencast your television. But
also just like one of those movies. It's just really great with an audience. Mm-hmm. I think that was the moment, there was a minute there where the director was sort of struggling a little bit with the studio, and everybody had the best intentions. But he had in his contract, he had a director's screening that they had to do. And so it was kind of like the first moment that the cat was out of the bag. And from there, then I guess apparently the next day they had decided it went so well for him that they decided to give him a final cut, which was incredible. And so this really is, I mean, his vision and again, the saga that he went through, going from my God, is anybody ever going to see this to... coming out. I guess, you know, I think a lot of films have experienced that, but this was just like actually being, you know, being in it was just a whole different deal.
So what made you, firstly, how did you put yourself out as a cinematographer, and how did you choose this to be the film that you were going to make that big step with?
Well, you know, so I'd been shooting music videos and commercials for a long time. And you know, I really, it's in any position from any perspective, it's hard to do things under the radar in this industry.
It's hard.
In any way,
sure.
Right?
Yeah. yeah.
And so I got, for me, you know, it was really important that if I did want to do cinematography, that there was a version of it that where I paid my dues in a sense. Yeah. And you know, after 15 years, you can go, well, you know, when does that moment come where you go, okay, I'm ready to, you know, and I guess, I don't know if it ever does, which is probably a good thing because, you know, this growth is always really important as a creative person or, within creative endeavors. So JT Molnar, the director, I knew, for several years. We were introduced by a gentleman who was working at Kodak, a guy named Steve Bellamy, who I'm sure you guys know, the legend, Steve Bellamy. And JT, over the years, would send me projects that he was writing or working on. He sent me this, and within 15 minutes, I was on the phone discussing how we could make this with the facility that I have, which was the other thing that I was growing over 15 years, just amassing gear and putting together something that would be, I guess, maybe, you know, a micro studio or facility.
Hmm. Sky Captain was part of the inspiration process for you to start collecting gear and start building a little studio yourself?
Not really. I mean, I think I guess Sky Captain, was 25 years ago. It was a great experience and all that, but I think I had, you know, really started focusing on truthfully, what we had developed and evolved, in an analog way. And sort of perfected in the 70s. I think I read somewhere that, you know, Taxi Driver, which is, you know, Travis Bickle driving around, and there's, you know, it's not Michael Bay, right?
Yeah.
I think it was a $3 million budget, but they had 90 days to make that film.
Yeah. Luxurious.
And I don't know, you know, people don't really talk about that. So for me, the whole idea of putting together a facility was about looking at trying to answer the dilemma of the economics. You know, if there's a revolution right now in the film industry, it's to address that from a practical standpoint, to be able to give people a better chance at making something that's meaningful or unique or original. Right now, I think that we are, you know, we're in this mindset where it's digital, it's keeping the camera rolling, it's, you know, thousands of hours of content put together or executed within 18 days or 24 days or whatever, 25 days. And we're buying it by the yard at this point.
Yeah.
And I think that does have an economic basis to it that... So to that was also one of the successes from my perspective of this film, because when you tally up everything, you know, I think it was probably a little bit more, but when you look at what actually went into production days for Strange Darling, I think we were living at around $4 million for this movie.
Wow.
And you know, yeah, it begged to be, you know, the script was 83 pages. It begged to be a film that was an 18-day shoot with four characters and da da da, you know. But we had started out with a 40-day schedule, and then it landed somewhere after going through, you know, a budget and da da da. At around 32 days, and then it's a long story. But you know, still, I think that becomes somewhat doable and realistic, where a director and the rest of the crew can come up for air and have lives and be able to just sort of step back and assess and make their movie in realistic terms. You know, it becomes worthwhile at that point to me.
This movie has a real stylized look, and it starts off, emblazoned across the screen, shot entirely on 35mm film.
I love that so much.
The director wanted to do that. And at first I was like, well, maybe it shouldn't matter about the medium, and we're immediately throwing people out of the movie. But he was right. I think it's a great thing, and it's a great nod, especially for Kodak and all of the folks over there that we want to support.
All right. So since you get in so early into this movie, like, you know, before the main credits, and basically give this disclaimer, tell us a little bit about the film technical process. You got would you choose a particular Kodak stock? What do you use? Some ARRI cameras? Do you use some anamorphic lenses? How did this come together? What are the building blocks of your technical stream?
I was in New York, and this was, I think, 8 or 9 years ago, and I wandered in, and they were selling their 35mm Aiton Penelope cameras for $3,000.
Yeah.
And with two mags included, and then I said, can you throw in two more mags? And he okay. And so, it was like when
the bottom had fallen,
film
out.
Was just gone. Right.
Yeah.
And so then I ordered, I didn't even know how to do it, but I ordered through some company, four rolls of 35mm film, 5219, 5207. And I think, I had the Tri-X in there, and I drove across the country and I shot the film, and then, got it back from PhotoChem, and just couldn't believe it. It was like a big wake up moment for me. And so then I, started looking at the costs of shooting film. And again, like, you know, the sort of feasibility of doing this, because, you know, when I had the digital cameras, I could just go out and shoot at anytime I wanted. And it was free, essentially. And I saw that the most expensive part of the whole pipeline, from buying film to shooting it to processing it and digitizing it, was digitizing it. That was 60% of the entire cost of shooting film. So I started doing research into scanners and all that, and found a company that was still making new scanners. They're called Laser Graphics, and they're just incredible, and the quality is incredible. And most companies where you would get your film scanned are using older 20-year-old technology that was incredible. But it's, you know, if you think of using a 20-year-old digital camera, it's, you know, that's what you're going to get. And so I did that, and then I just went from there, and that's how I met J.T. Molnar. We have a mutual love and regard for film, and it's not just the look or the feel and the contrasts and the tones of film, but it's also the process. You know, speaking from an actor's point of view, again, you know, like you're working, and again, it's just the notion of buying it by the yard, where it's just hosing down a scene, as they say, with four different cameras.
Yeah.
And just, you know, suddenly who's directing and what's going on here, and just shooting all the different sort of checking off boxes as you're going, as opposed to really sitting down and making your film, on paper first, and then going into and drawing it with storyboards, and then going in and looking at how everything is visual. JT and I, I'm sorry, these are really long answers, but I
no, this is great.
This is great. Absolutely. But, no, this is what we want to know.
JT and I spent 4 months in working together. It was during COVID, so we were Zooming and we would work together at the shop, putting together a typed out 82 page shot list that not only had you know, the sort of the schedule for each day according to what we wanted to do, knowing what we had at that time, I think 36 days. So we were executing everything and going, okay, so what's possible with the, you know, I have four in G&E and four, you know, with the people that we have, what's possible, 12 setups a day with several, you know, different lens setups there. And then, you know, here are the tools that we're going to be using to execute these shots. So it was really creative as far as the language with the film was, but it was also a practical reference for us to go, okay, so for everybody. And then we would hand that out to all the department heads every day. And that was really sort of like a lifeline. Of course, everybody says you deviate from that, of course, because you know, making films is extemporaneous. And it is, you know, like, watch me dance. You know, like, let's go. Problem solving. And you can't predict any of that. But again, it was a lifeline for us. And I guess that was how the language and the visual style, you know, and also just testing is so important, as everybody, the same old song, you know, and shooting. I tried several different lenses. I knew that I used the Cook anamorphics, the Arri LT and ST, Arri Cam STs and LTs, and a 4-3-5, and then a 2-3-5, which we did for the car mount stuff.
Yeah, you know, I'm so glad you brought up the car mount. And the first sort of car mount shot you see in this is this trailer hitch shot.
Yeah.
I think that, and it's a great shot, but it immediately, you know, from the get-go, from the first images of this movie is so stylized. But first of all, I'm struck by two things. One, you've got serious chops. There's a real intention through the whole way that this movie is put together visually. How did you approach, like, cause I find certainly when I talk to a lot of DPs on this show, it can be so difficult to figure out that pacing, that, that visual change, that rhythm that you get into.
The dance, like you just said, the dance.
Exactly. Yeah. When you're working with the director and you're figuring all this out, what's your process? And do you take inspiration from other people? How do you figure out, you know, the way that you put this movie together like this visually?
It's all of that, you know, I guess the complexity of a film and arriving to any kind of, you know, really like unique experience is such a challenge and such an open. There's so many possibilities, you know, just, and if you just isolate that to the camera, for instance, you know, how you're going to compose and the geometry of what you're going to see, the depth, the three-dimensionality of the camera moving, when the camera's going to move, the colors, the texture of the image, it all of that, a lot of it comes from essentially just having a good foundation. I think you gotta watch movies, you know, you gotta I remember talking to Richard Linklater. I was 21 years old, I think, and I was like, so, okay, so if I wanted to have your film education, you know, understanding, what would I have to do? And he looked at me and he was like, you would have to watch two movies a day for the next 2 years. And for that, always sort of like, I was like, oh, interesting. And so at a certain point, I think I decided to do that. And I, you know, it's that, but it's also not necessarily simply just volume, but it's also really, there's nothing like the third viewing of a film, and I'm talking like consecutively, to really get in and know, understand certain things that you missed on the first and second viewing, or even, you know, beyond that, and to understand, oh, how did they do that? Because everything in a film, especially when you understand what the editing process is, everything becomes intentional. Even if in production it wasn't intentional on the day, what the fact that somebody left it in, or the fact that somebody, you know, maybe perhaps it wasn't, it everything is intentional. In that document that I mentioned earlier, you know, it was really about putting it all together and restraint. JT and I watched movies together. I found this one movie called Mademoiselle, after we linked into the, you know, the 1960s British contingent of cinematographers, Freddie Francis,
Oswald
Morris, David Watkin, who to me is like, I mean, he's the great David Watkin, going back to Jack Cardiff and, you take a movie like The Innocents, which was anamorphic, David Watkin favored when Panavision B series, you know, emerged, and he favored that for The Devils, which is a phenomenal.
Oh yeah.
Beautifully
it's a
shot.
Great movie. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the production design in that film is just ridiculous. But really, there was something analogous to the film Mademoiselle. Thematically, there are some things in that movie that when you watch it and you look at the framing and how they're cutting it using mirrors and one profile here and then in her bedroom and then the next profile, and sort of discombobulating, but it comes from character, you know? And I say that for being an actor, being well aware that I'm an actor, but, you know, and so I don't want to be one-sided, but I think a lot of people will agree with me, a lot of directors and cinematographers, and this is why so much emphasis is put on, you know, characters and, you know, actors, the importance of making sure that they have everything that they can do in order to execute their job, digital versus film, where you go, you know, skin tones are for me extremely important. And this is why film will always dominate, because of the complexity of what emulsion and grain will do to a face over a digital sort of blank. Anyways, I could go on there, but
I kept taking note of that kind of stuff while I was watching your film, and noting like the richness of the skin tones and the colors and everything. And I feel like we've all become so we've all become so inured to the digital look of everything, and it's nothing wrong with it, but
it's like MP3 files and versus vinyl, like, you know, we're all used to that. But when you actually put on vinyl, you're like, oh. Right, now you're hearing things that you've never, and it becomes more of an emotional experience. The music does, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, like for instance, so like it really does. I guess the perspective is the script and the writing and getting a better understanding of what the characters are going through. And again, this is cinematography starting out from an objective perspective, trying to become more subjective. But like for instance, there's a scene in Strange Darling in a truck where they're talking, and it's this I think it's an 8 or 9 page scene. And they basically pull up and park in front of a big blue neon sign, and we we thought, well, here's an idea where these characters are possibly sort of isolated in their own psychological black holes. And so, you know, this is the idea. I don't know if we achieved it, We initially wanted to do, I forget what, but it's a chopped up truck and be able to put the camera in front of, you know, so we could have a wider lens and close on her and him in order to sort of put black around them and just have them in this like blue light. So they're almost kind of like, you know, like this.
Yeah.
And then have this conversation that starts this journey for them. And so that all of what the characters were possibly going through informed the lighting and what the camera was going to do, the lens choice, the focal length, and all of that. And, you know, I guess that's a very specific example. And again, I'm finding myself going on and on and on.
Well, but this was like one of those on the show. That was one of those moments because the movie starts so explosively and then it, and then shortly after that, it goes to this very subdued scene bathed in this like very saturated, beautiful, gorgeous blue light. And that was a fight, by the way.
That was like, because, you know, you have 10 minutes of the movie or a big chunk of the movie and it's basically monochromatic blue.
Yeah.
And it's two people talking in the front seat of the truck. But you know, I think it worked and I'll say this it worked really because of those actors and how prepared they were and how hungry they were to come to work.
Well, it's also like, I hate the term slow burn because a lot of times a slow burn movie is a movie that can only think of three things to have happen in it instead of five. Like your movie starts so explosively and creates such a puzzle box. And then you just stick us in a car with these two people. And so the whole time I'm like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen?
Yeah.
And it's the perfect simmer. I mean, and also
that's JT. Yeah. Yeah.
Your use of that blue light, that color that you lit with made me go, color matters in this movie. Color is important. And so I started paying attention to when she's in the bathroom and she's bathed in the red light. And also just like, I know it's not a cinematography thing, but the color of her hair and all that stuff. Like I was like, oh, there's a color thing going on in this
movie. The color of the scrubs, the color of the Pinto, the color of everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Like, a lot of intention.
You know, that's JT. I mean, really in production design, Priscilla Elliott, who's just incredible. And what she had to do, the hurdles that she had to jump over, I can't even, it's amazing. A lot of that was born out of, you know, I mean, came from JT and his vision and what he wanted to do. If you know, the first, I think 20 minutes of the movie, there's no dialogue whatsoever, but it's just action. And then you get seated into this truck. And it was all just, you know, conversations and developing that. And when you force yourself as a filmmaker, director, cinematographer to do that, you know, again, for months and 5 months to make your movie. I remember when we got to the end of that document, it was like this thing where you're like, almost like you gave birth to something, you know, like it was like, well, there it is. Now it's just a matter of executing it. Right. But that was one of the interesting things. And that's one of the exciting things. I remember also one of the things with JT, we had talked about, I was in an acting class when I was 16 years old, the second time I went, Quincy Jones came and spoke to the class and it ended up being like 3 hours. And it was like one of the most incredible nights of my life as a 16-year-old kid. And he recounted a story where it was, he was in the studio with Miles Davis and he had overheard Miles Davis talking to another saxophonist. And he said, do you ever just try to play the wrong notes? Like, just do what's wrong to sort of try to find your way back. And it stuck with me. It was something that reverberated with me where, you know, and so for us, you know, there was this thing where we just wanted to do what was in a way, it's just sort of in a brash attempt to try to find something unique or find something that wasn't, because there's so much content and there's a lot of great work, you know, but to sort of like rattle the cage, I guess, you know, and that really is JT and just the you know, the genius of him and his whole process.
All right, so that was Giovanni Ribisi, part one. Come back for the thrilling conclusion next week and hear part two. You know, can I say one of the things that I love about talking to him about this is that he's very smart, he's very thoughtful, he's very creative, but he's been thinking about filmmaking from a completely different point of view from cinematography most of his career. And so in a lot of ways, he's like thinking more deeply about it, or at least expressing himself more deeply about it than people who, they just do this day in, day out. Like I feel like every piece of it is so meaningful to him, and it kind of helps me unpack for myself what I find so meaningful about it as a non-DP that I am.
Yeah, during the Q&A, Giovanni mentioned a Chekhov quote, which I'd never heard before, which I thought was quite good. He said something to the effect of that when a writer envisions a play, they've got a very clear idea of what that play will be in their mind. When an actor envisions the play, they have the exact opposite idea of what the writer had for that play, and it's that they somehow meet in the middle. So I'm sorry, nice. Is that not the quote?
No, I mean, no, I hadn't heard that quote.
Oh, I hadn't heard that quote either. And he was responding directly to someone who was like, hey, you know, how does, you know, working as an actor inform your cinematography? And I thought that was a very interesting quote. And he's like, well, it's probably like that Chekhov quote where cinematography fits in there too. Like, you know, there's another thing, and you have to kind of meet in the middle. You have to try to make all of these different things work. And so maybe there is a you know, an envisioning that happens also with, you know, the writer, the director, and the cinematographer, and the actors, all of them in contributing to that vision of what's going to be on the screen. So anyway, yeah.
What a cool freaking guy. I just hope he keeps at it.
Yeah. And you know what? I think he's going to have to get really used to that question of like, hey, are you going to be a DP now? Because, you know, I think that is going to be one of those things that people.
I just want to say you can do both.
You absolutely can do both.
You don't have to be one thing or another in life.
And you know what? And I don't believe that anyone is really just one thing. I think that there, a lot of people have lots of different things. And so it's just, you know, this industry is.
I think that it's just being a DP is like such a specific technical discipline that it's hard to imagine that someone would do that. Although, like, how many DPs also direct? Dozens, hundreds. Like, how many actors also direct? Same thing. Like,
I don't know if you saw The Fall Guy, but that's kind of like the whole movie starts off as like, you know, the camera operator becomes a DP. So, you know, the camera operator becomes the director. So that's the, you know, that's the whole
thing. I'm to my shame, I haven't seen it yet, but I haven't
seen it. Okay. It's quite good, actually.
It was a busy month for me.
And now, Short Ends.
Anyway, so let's get to our Short Ends today. What is your wacky obsession of this week that's keeping you up late at night staring at the ceiling, can't stop the brain race?
There's a new television show called Time Bandits. And Time Bandits is, of course, based on the 1981 Terry Gilliam movie of the same
title. Never heard of it.
You're a liar. I think the original Terry Gilliam Time Bandits is a masterpiece. I think it's wonderful. Agreed. I saw it in the theater when I was a kid. It had a real impact on me. So to say that my hopes were really high for Time Bandits, they were. I went into it going like, oh my God, how is it going to match this? I think that Taika Waititi, who is put this whole thing together, has decided I'm not trying to do that. I'm going to do my own take on it. I would say the original Time Bandits is a much darker story. It's dark and, you know, definitely has sort of a Terry Gilliam vibe. This has got more of a Taika Waititi vibe. It is more, you know, the stakes are lower, even though there's, you know, the character of pure evil and, you know, the supreme being and all the stuff. It's just, it's a lighter story. Now, do I dislike it? No, I am enjoying it, but it's just not the same. So, While I think about all the different ways that someone could lean into it, it actually feels to me exactly like Taika Waititi is doing Terry Gilliam. So, and that's not necessarily bad. I like Taika Waititi. I like what he does. I like his whole Jermaine Clement crew. I love all the stuff. And Lisa Kudrow's in it, and she does very much her, you know, her Lisa Kudrow best in playing a part that is. I don't want to spoil it, but it's a you know, memorable part from the. It's a very different casting for a memorable part from the original movie. So that being said, Time Bandits. I'm obsessed with it. I'm not sure that it 100% works for me in my adult brain, but my kids think it's amazing. And they found, I tried to show them the beginning of Terry Gilliam's version of Time Bandits, and they were kind of like, yeah, whatever. They were more interested in this lighter, happier, friendlier version. So yeah, I don't know. It's kind of been what I'm thinking about.
Generation Alpha, just not dark enough, people. Come on.
You know, yeah, there was something to be said about the darkness. And there is dark elements to this, but you never really are too worried. Everyone plays it pretty light. So anyway, I like it. I'm going to keep watching it. I'm 4 episodes behind now. But at least when it comes out, it drops 2 episodes at a time. Time Bandits, Apple TV Plus. I should have known because I just talked about Sunny last week. But, you know, it's interesting. They don't show Sunny in sort of like their lineup, so it's like I have to search for it. It's weird how Apple TV decides some shows are worthy of extra promotion and others are not. And I don't know how they do that determinations.
Apple TV Plus has made some great stuff, but it's all a head scratcher to me. I mean, we didn't get into it, but one of the news items last week was Apple TV Plus. Apple was set to release this new George Clooney, Brad Pitt movie called Wolves. And then it was going to get a normal theatrical run, and then they decided to just give it 1 week in the theaters and then drop it onto Apple TV Plus. And it's like pretty star-driven movie that would probably do well, but they just had a theatrical flop, and like they haven't been able to unpack how to make a theatrical hit work. And it goes back to what I always kind of get on my soapbox about, which is technology companies making entertainment. Like, they don't exactly get it in the same way that a studio does. But the flip of that, of course, is that the technology companies have been way better at making streaming services than Paramount. And, well, Peacock, I feel like, has finally caught up. But, like, a lot of the legacy television network stuff that's gone to streaming hasn't worked nearly as well as stuff like, obviously, Netflix.
It is interesting to see what the streamers are doing that are technology companies versus legacy media, because, you know, there's definitely some.
I feel like they each have a piece of what'll make it work, and neither one of them are doing it all at the same time. Except Netflix is closer than the rest, but even Netflix, when they do a theatrical release, they bungle it, you know. And I shouldn't say they bungle it, but it's not their strong suit. They're much better at releasing stuff on Netflix proper. But people, like, I've been going to the movies a lot more recently, and people still have a hunger to go see movies in the theater. I don't think theatrical is as dead as we thought, you know, at the beginning of the summer, honestly.
Far from it. So, Ben, what is your obsession this week? What is your short end?
So I have a weird rabbit hole.
You always have a weird something.
I do. I have a weird rabbit hole. I have a weird rabbit hole I went down on YouTube. And I feel like the YouTube algorithm has just figured me out. And so it's this dude's channel named Max Vega. And what Max Vega does, are you familiar with this dude? It's at Max Vega KUN. And what Max Vega does is he finds old cameras, usually old video cameras, pops them open, puts modern recording equipment on them, sticks some kind of a monitor on top sometimes. If they take C-mount lenses, maybe he'll put a different lens on it. And he finds like old camera gear from the 80s, video cameras. And like he shows you step by step how he like uses electrical devices to kind of see what's corresponding to what on the circuit board or whatever. And so he figures out, oh, this is audio, this is audio left, audio right, this is video, this is power, this is ground. And then like takes the shit apart and figures out how to get usable digital images out of these old cameras. And
it's Vega KUN.
Yes, correct.
Wow. Okay. So amazing. He has 532 subscribers, and the YouTube algorithm totally, you know, picked him out and displayed him, and you you went down that rabbit hole. That's cool.
I'm definitely one of those proud 532. I just think it's really interesting what he's doing, and it's a lot of it's DIY stuff. He shows you the gear he's getting. You know, it's like these little, I think it's called like a little DVR that you can stick an SD card in. So once you get the video signal out, it can record onto an SD card, and he's getting like old looking video, but you know, like, I mean, I have like right over here, I have a VHS camcorder, and I don't know that I will ever fire it back up necessarily, but I have had the thought of like, oh, if I could record digitally to it, it might be fun for a specific kind of project to mess around with.
I'll one up you a little on this, just because
I know you will, because you're a total hacker.
Well, you know, it's been going on for some time, but there are some really, really amazing Sony cameras that are still kicking around out there. One of them is called the F23. The other is called the F35. These are like $200,000, $300,000 cameras back in 2007, 2008, that sort of time period. You can put a $150 to $500 recorder on there and record with these incredibly expensive cameras from the day and get amazing, like really pretty amazing looking stuff. But
how much can you get those cameras for now though? Like how much do they retail for?
Probably under $2,000, something like that. Wow. But the thing was, is they were tape based. You had to have this massive HD cam SR recorder that went on the back of it. And now you don't need that. You can get the SDI out, go into your little recorder system, your little Ninja. I knew people who were doing that back then. This guy actually, who's never been on the show, his name's McGregor. He came to me with his F35, you know, probably right around that time. He was like, forget the tape. I want to go to this little recorder. And it was a very new thing at that time. So there wasn't a lot of stuff. But today you can get all kinds of little recorders, and especially ones that are pretty darn good. And yeah, I can't wait to see, like, Max has got one extra subscriber now. He's now got 533 subscribers because he's doing some fun stuff, it looks like, here with VHS, VHS-C. It's like, you know, all kinds
of stuff. No, he's doing cool stuff. And the thing is that, like, back in the day, that was like the high-tech thing that you would go get at Circuit City or Best Buy or something. And it would be the highest end that somebody like you or me could possibly, you know, hope to film before, you know, long before we got to where we are now. But now when you look at the images he's creating, there's like an instant nostalgia to them because they feel like they're from the early 80s in the way that Super 8 looked like it was from the 1960s.
Exactly.
And you know, and I love Super 8. I love that, but it's interesting to kind of see how, like, basically how every time period's inferior technology becomes a nostalgic throwback, you know, once you get 20, 30 years down the road.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what they're going to be saying about 2024. Just wait till 2044. It's going
No, whatever we have, they'll be like, oh my God, they only had 8K. You know, now we shoot in, you know, bicubic 64K, and you know, and we've added more colors to your eyes. Your eyes can see more colors. Way back then, you know, we hadn't figured out how to inject new rods and cones into your eyes yet.
Are you kidding? They're just beaming the stories directly into your brain. No one even has screens. Your brain just sees them.
It's like Total Recall. Anyway, Ilya, so let's wrap up part one of our Giovanni Ribisi interview. Where can people find you?
You can find me over at Hot Rod Cameras in either Burbank or Portland, Oregon, hotrodcameras.com. Ben, where can people find you?
You can find me in Sherman Oaks, California, which is, for those of you who aren't familiar with LA, it's the valley, it's the suburbs.
It's and a nice you can part find of the valley. It really is.
It is. Yes, I could almost walk to where they filmed Fast Times at Ridgemont High. You can also find me at benrock.com. There you'll find links to whatever you want to know about me. Feel free to reach out, say hi. Had somebody reach out and say hi to me just today on Facebook. It was very nice, just to give us a shout out. In fact, I should give that person a shout out while I'm shouting out, having been shouted out.
Yeah, you might as well.
That's a convoluted sentence.
I understand what you're trying to do. You're giving the shouts to the chefs.
I hope I'm pronouncing the name correctly. I believe it is Gwyn Hemmings. And they said, "Hi Ben, hope you are well. I have been a fan of the Cinematography Podcast for many years, and I thought it was about time I got in touch to thank you for all the wonderful interviews and insights. Keep up the excellent work. I look forward to the day you find a satisfactory line to end the show on. All the best." Gwyn is from Manchester.
You know what? Let's actually, we never do this. Why don't we give? You know, I'm so glad that Gwyn reached out, but we should, you know, once in a while tell people to, you know, hey, write us a review. You could write us a review on iTunes or Spotify, whatever you're using. Those reviews actually really do help, you know, help get the show recommended to other people who are interested in cinematography and filmmaking and the television and movie industry. So if you think we're valuable, hey, you know, you don't have to subscribe. It'd be great if you subscribed. You don't have to like. It's great if you liked. But if you could write a review, if you do something like that, to something public out there, that really does a lot. It then tells the algorithm. If you're watching us on YouTube right now, I'm sorry, but if you're watching us on YouTube right now, if you're looking at my face, hey,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, you know, if you do those things, if you do the likes and the subscribes, it tells the algorithm, hey, someone else out there kind of like this person might like this too. So it helps us a lot. I really appreciate it.
In no way is that a castigation of Gwen. Thank you for reaching out.
So Ben, who do we have to thank for this episode? Who made this show possible?
As always, Michael Dispenza, our kick-ass editor, who hopefully we're not making his job too hellish today. We got to thank our incredible, amazing, would cease to exist without her producer, Alana Cody. Thank you so much, Alana, for all the work you do, and you get us some dream level interviews like this one that we're doing today. And last but never least, big thanks to Kaes Alektrakci, who composed every bit of music you heard on this episode. Check him out at musicbykaes.com. Hire him to do one of the many things that I've talked about him doing. He's a great guy. I'll be seeing him tonight.
Fantastic. Hey, did you feel that earthquake the other day? I think it was centered right about where Kaes was. So, you know, I bet he really
felt it. It was Pasadena, but yeah, it shook for like 45 seconds. It didn't stop very quickly.
Yeah, all right. So Ben,
people were calling me and they were like, Are you okay? I'm like, we didn't even have anything fall off a shelf. It's just the house shook a lot.
Well, you know, whole lot of shaking going on. I'm glad that you survived. Yeah, and it seemed like everybody survived, which is great.
All right. So Ilya, would you like you take us out?
I took us out last time. It's your turn. How about I'm gonna hit stop? I'm gonna hit cut right now.
I'm gonna hit cut. Bye.
Bye.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.